What kind of leadership has been denied the people of Pakistan after the coup against Imran Khan? Who are the new rulers replacing Khan, and what do they plan for Pakistan? Does a civil war await the people robbed of their picked leader? What could a suicide death committed by the Baluchistan Liberation Army mean for the future of Chinese-Pakistani relations? Coming up on this week's Global Research News Hour, we delve some more into the coup of Pakistani leader Imran Khan, this time examining the consequences for the country and the region. In our first half hour, we will air an excerpt of a special address by Imran Khan to the UN, critical of the situation with India. In our second half hour, we will be joined by Abdul Jabbar, an academic and scholar in the United States, to talk about his latest essay, American-Style Colonialism and Imperialism, with Pakistan, the latest victim. Finally, we will have a discussion of a terrorist attack likely targeting the hub of the Chinese-Pakistan Economic Corridor and setting the stage for further disruption in months and years to come. On this week's program, the removal of Imran Khan Part 2, back to dismantling Pakistan's relationships with China and Russia. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 13th, 2022. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are featured on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. The World Health Organization has already begun drafting a global pandemic treaty on pandemic preparedness. What form will it take? What teeth will it have? How will it further the globalists in cementing the biosecurity grid into place? James breaks it down in today's episode of the Corporate Report podcast. That was from the introduction under the headline Video, the Global Pandemic Treaty, What You Need to Know, James Corbett, by James Corbett, posted May 11th, originally published on the Corbett Report. Instead of the coffee and cake run from St. Petersburg to Rotterdam, those same ships now, at a minimum, must go to storage facilities in the Bahamas and the Caribbean, if not all the way to China or India, their final destination. Read Poshar's post or the Zero Hedge article linked above to get a sense of the scale of the disruption. This supply shock within the tanker market and the downstream effects of the added costs to the voyages, it is hoped, will create a cascading backup within the Russian oil industry, forcing the forecasted production hits. This will in turn eat into its positive trade balance, which is, quote, fueling Putin's war machine, unquote. It will also present the opportunity for Russia's competitors to come in and steal market share from them. That comes from the article, The Real Reason Behind the EU's Drive to Embargo Russian Oil, by Tom Luongo, posted May 11th, originally published in Covert Action magazine. Israel's deliberate killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akleh amounts to a de facto execution and possibly a war crime, said Michael Bickert, vice president of CJPME. Although several Canadian officials have expressed support for an investigation into this incident, CJPME points out that Israel has proven itself incapable of investigating or prosecuting Israeli attacks against Palestinians. That comes from the article, Israel's execution of Al Jazeera journalist requires international investigation, by Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, posted May 12th, originally published on CJPME. The emergence of Ukraine as a test field for a number of conflicting agendas is providing platforms for nationalist counterpoints to globalist schemes of post-nationalist transformation. Indeed, the geopolitical effects rippling throughout the world since the Russian armed forces entered Ukraine on 24th of February include the locating of possible escape routes from the tyrannies being imposed in the name of combating epidemics of disease. The antipathies directed Russia have run towards radical extremes. The antipathies point towards the goal of ultimately destroying Russia and depriving its people of any basis for independent self-determination outside the grip of the primary banking institutions emerging from Anglo-America, Bretton Woods, Fed, Regional Development Banks, BIS. Hence, the anti-Russian financial assault points towards the same oppressive trajectories as those promoted in the name of the fake fight to vanquish COVID-19. That comes from the article Financial Reset and Economic Warfare Against Humanity, How Global Relations Should Be Restructured to Ensure National Sovereignty, by Professor Anthony J. Hall, posted May 12th. Graham promoted a new piece of legislation he co-authored with Senator Richard Blumenthal that calls on the White House to designate Russia as a state sponsor of terrorism. Senator Graham published an op-ed Friday arguing the designation will allow the U.S. to conduct more legal and economic warfare against Russia. However, Graham does not link Russia to a terrorist group. Rather, he compares the invasion of Ukraine to the Nazi military campaign during World War II and claims Vladimir Putin is a, quote, megalomaniac wanting to rewrite the map of Europe and recreate the former Russian Empire, unquote. The senator also urges the passing of the $33 billion aid bill for Ukraine, prosecuting Putin for war crimes through the International Criminal Court, and putting, quote, more weapons in theater that can target the Russian military offensively, unquote. That comes from the article, Senator Lindsey Graham pushes to designate Moscow as a state sponsor of terror, escalates support for Kiev. By Kyle Anzalone, posted May 11th, originally published on antiwar.com. We therefore hope that you will remember your original position and will not deliver any more heavy weapons to Ukraine, either directly or indirectly. On the contrary, we urge you to do everything you can to ensure that a ceasefire can be reached as soon as possible, a compromise that both sides can accept. We share the verdict on Russian aggression as a breach of the basic norm of international law. We also share the conviction that there is a fundamental political and moral duty not to back down from aggressive violence without resistance. But everything that can be derived from this has its limits in other imperatives of political ethics. That was from Open Letter to Germany's Chancellor Scholz on the Risks of a Third World War, the Need for a Curfew, by Andreas Dressen, Lars Eidinger, Alexander Kluge and et al., posted May 11th, originally published in German on Emma.
These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
What follows is an excerpt of Imran Khan, Prime Minister of the Islamic Republic of Pakistan, Speaking to the United Nations on September 27, 2019, he was addressing the general debate of the 74th session of the General Assembly of the UN during the week of September 24, 2019. He's concerned about Kashmir and was concerned that once the curfew is lifted, there would be a bloodbath. He adds, quote, "It will have consequences for the world, which is why I repeat I am here. Because I'm warning you, it is not a threat. It's a fair worry that where we are we heading." Unquote. He stresses near the end, quote, "When a nuclear-armed country fights to the end, it will have consequences far beyond the borders. Here is the speech, courtesy of the United Nations."
The election campaign, Mr. Modi used words like, "This is just a trailer. The movie is about to start. I went into Pakistan and taught them a lesson." This was the election campaign. Okay, so we thought, you know, us politicians make all these statements to win elections. So, okay, after elections, we'll get back to our normal relationship. Well, the moment the elections ended, we approached India. No response, but then we discovered they were trying to push us in the fat of blacklist to bankrupt us. That's when we realized there was an agenda. And that agenda became obvious on the 5th August when India went against 11 United Nations Security Council resolutions, which say that Kashmir is a disputed territory and the people of Kashmir have the right of self-determination. They went against that. They went against Simla Accord, which is about bilateral, sorting out our differences through bilateral means, went against that. They actually went against the Indian Constitution. Illegally, they revoked Article 370, which gave Kashmir the special status. They got an extra 180,000 troops there. Total number of security forces in Kashmir now are 900,000. And they put 8 million people of Kashmir under curfew. Mr. President, now I just briefly want to make the people understand, how can anyone do something like this? And for that, I have to explain to you what is RSS. RSS, Mr. Narendra Modi is a life member of RSS. RSS was an organization that was inspired by Adolf Hitler and Mussolini, came about in 1925. They believed in racial purity, racial superiority. They also believed they were an Aryan race like the Nazi believed they were an Aryan race. All that I'm saying can be verified. This is the time of information revolution. You can Google all this, what I'm saying. But it is very important for me to explain this to you so you know what is happening in India. This RSS believed in the ethnic cleansing of Muslims from India. At one point, there was racial superiority of the Hindu race. Secondly, it was hatred for the Muslims and for the Christians because they believed that this golden age of Hindu civilization was stopped because of Muslim rule centuries back and then the British rule of India. So it was racial superiority and hatred for Muslims and Christians. This is openly stated. You look at the founding fathers of RSS, Golwalkar and Savarskar. Just Google them and you'll find out. And this ideology of hate is what murdered the great Mahatma Gandhi, in 1948. It was this ideology of hate that made Narendra Modi in 2002 do a pogrom against Muslims in Gujarat when he was the chief minister. He allowed 3 days for these RSS goons who were inspired by the Hitler brown shirts. They actually wear brown shirts. This RSS, the Congress Home Minister gave a statement that in RSS camps, terrorists are being trained. And these terrorists butchered 2,000 Muslims and 150,000 Muslims were made homeless. Narendra Modi could not travel to the US because of that. And I need to make you understand this background before I explain to you that what sort of a mindset would lay siege to 8 million people with 900,000 troops? Women, children, sick people, locked in as animals. In fact, of what I know of England, if 8 million animals were locked in, the RSPCA would have made a lot of noise about it. These are human beings. And Mr. President, what comes with racial superiority, these illusions of Aryan superior race, is arrogance. The two go together. And it's arrogance that makes people make mistakes and do stupid things, cruel things like what Narendra Modi has done. It's sheer arrogance. And it's arrogance that has blinded him from the fact that what is going to happen when the curfew is lifted? Has he thought about it? This hasn't been thought through. What is he going to do when he lifts the curfew? Does he think that people of Kashmir will quietly accept the status quo because India has changed the constitution and taken away the special status? They'll accept that? Mr. President, 100,000 Kashmiris have died in the past 30 years because they were denied the right given by the United Nations, the right for self-determination. 100,000 have died and 11,000 women have been raped. There are two United Nations human rights reports on this. The world hasn't done anything. Because India is a huge market, 1.2 billion people. Sadly, the material prevails over the human. But this has serious consequences. Again, I repeat, that's why I'm here. Look, what is going to happen when the curfew is lifted will be a bloodbath. The people will come out. There are 900,000 troops there. They haven't come to, as Narendra Modi says, he's done this to for prosperity of Kashmir. This is supposed to be for the development. These 900,000 troops, what are they going to do when they come out? There'll be a bloodbath. Has he thought it through what happens then? Mr. President, has anyone thought that what happens when there is a bloodbath? What do you think the impact will have on people of Kashmir? What do you think they will think the way they have been boxed in their houses, treated like worse than animals, no rights? Thousands of all the political leadership has been arrested, taken out of Kashmir. Even those Kashmiri leaders who were pro-India have been taken out. 13,000 boys have been picked up and taken to God knows which destinations. So what do they think? What will the people of Kashmir do when they lift the curfew? They will be out in the streets. And what will these soldiers do? They will shoot them. They've already used pellet guns, blinded young boys. In the last 6 years, the 5 years, the oppression that has gone on in Kashmir. And so Kashmiris will be further radicalized. Mr. President, there will be another Palwama. And guess what? India will blame us. They're already blaming us. They're saying this, all this is happening because of Pakistan. One of their defense ministers said, there are 500 terrorists lined up on the border to go in. Why would Pakistan send 500 terrorists when there are 900,000 troops? What impact are they going to make? What will they do? And why would? Don't we know that the moment there is some terrorist attack, all that will happen is there'll be further cruelty and oppression of the people of Kashmir. We will just give the 900,000 troops to further crush the people of Kashmir. And then we'll give the Indian government an excuse that, look, Pakistan is a terrorist state, and this mantra that has gone on, Islamic terrorism. The moment you use this catchword, Islamic terrorism, the whole world turns away. No one talks about human rights. You can do whatever you want, which is what has happened in Kashmir, because they keep using this word, Islamic terrorism. And this is what they're doing right now. What do we benefit from further increasing the cruelty on the people of Kashmir? And why would we want this? But there is no other narrative left for India. As when they lift the curfew, whatever happens, Pakistan will be blamed, and there is always a danger of another Palwama. They might come and bomb us again, and then another cycle might start. And what does Narendra Modi think that 180 million Muslims of India are thinking right now? Aren't they watching these Kashmiris stuck inside, for 55 days they've been stuck in? Aren't they watching? What do you think? Don't you think that the Muslims will be radicalized in India? And I'm talking about 180 million people. And when they get radicalized, there will be some incident in India somewhere down the line. Again, we will be blamed. And I'm warning you right now, again, we will be blamed. And Mr. President, what about 1.3 billion Muslims who are watching this? And they know that it is only happening in Kashmir because they are Kashmiri Muslims. This is not happening to Kashmiri Hindus. They know that this is happening because of their religion. So what do you think they will be thinking? What do you think the Jewish community would think if they were 8,000 Jews stuck like this? What do you think Europeans would think? What do we think? I mean, any human community, if their members are stuck like that, what do you think they will think? Are we a children of a lesser God? Is it not going to cause us pain? And then I'll tell you what will happen. People will, in the 1.3 billion Muslims, someone will pick up arms. I know we've been brought up with films, Western films. This good, decent guy doesn't get justice. He decides to pick up a gun and start seeking justice. There was a film made in New York, famous film called Death Wish. This guy gets mugged by his wife gets killed or something. He can't get justice. He picks up a gun and he goes around shooting muggers. And the whole cinema cheers him on. So what do you think the Muslims are thinking right now? If there is a bloodbath, there will be Muslims becoming radicals, not because of Islam, but because of what they will see, that there's no justice when it comes to Muslims. There were Rohingya Muslims, Myanmar, who are, God knows, almost 1 million people out, ethnic cleansing. What was the response of the world community? So what do you think will be the response of 1.3 billion Muslims? I picture myself I'm in Kashmir. I've been locked up for 55 days. I have heard about and there are rapes, Indian Army going into homes, soldiers. Would I want to live this humiliation? Would I want to live like that? I would pick up a gun. You're forcing people. You are forcing people into radicalization. When people lose the will to live, what is there to live for? And this is what, if you can do this to human beings, you are actually radicalizing people. And so, Mr. President, I want to repeat here, this is one of the most critical times. There will be a reaction to this. Pakistan will be blamed. Two nuclear-armed countries will come face to face like we came in February. And before we head in that direction, the United Nations has a responsibility. This is why the United Nations came into being in 1945. You were supposed to stop this happening. I feel we are back to 1939, Munich. Czechoslovakia has been taken, annexed. What is the world community going to do? Is it going to appease a market of 1.2 billion, or is it going to stand up for justice and humanity? If this goes wrong, you hope for the best, but be prepared for the worst. If a conventional war starts between the two countries, Mr. President, if a conventional war starts, and anything could happen, but supposing a country seven times smaller than its neighbor is faced with the choice, either you surrender or you fight for your freedom till death, what will we do? I ask myself this question. And my belief is, la ilaha illallah, there is no God but one. And we will fight. And when a nuclear-armed country fights to the end, it will have consequences far beyond the borders. It will have consequences for the world, which is why I repeat I'm here. Because I'm warning you, it's not a threat. It's a fair worry that where are we headed? And I've come here to tell the UN, you've got to, this is a test for the United Nations. You are the one who guaranteed the people of Kashmir the right of self-determination. They are suffering because of that. And this is the time. This is the time not to appease, like in 1939 appeasement took place. This is the time to take action. And number one action must be that India must lift this inhuman curfew, which has lasted for 55 days. It must free all political prisoners, and especially those 13,000 boys that have been picked up. Parents don't know where they've disappeared. And then the world community must give the people of Kashmir their right of self-determination. Thank you.
That was Imran Khan, Prime Minister of Pakistan, addressing the UN on September 27, 2019. We will be back after a brief break with a conversation with Abdul Jabbar. Stay where you are.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. This is Michael Welch for the Global Research News Hour, and the story of the Pakistan coup against Imran Khan is
still an ongoing issue. Now, 1 month into the new regime in power, and Imran is delighting the many hundreds of thousands in the streets. So we're going to get a take by a new individual. His name is Abdul Jabbar. He taught English and interdisciplinary studies for 36 years on a full-time basis at City College of San Francisco, including visiting professorship at University of California, Berkeley. He's a recipient of a Fulbright Scholarship and two National Endowment for the Humanities Awards. He received his PhD in English from Case Western University in Cleveland, Ohio, and has written three books. His latest, The Promise, Reality, and Potential of America's Cultural Diversity, is in the process of publication. He's published several articles on literary, political, and similar topics. His video lectures are available on YouTube, and he has been following developments in Pakistan with great interest and concern, both from professional and personal points of view. Professor Jabbar, welcome to the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you for having me on your program, Michael.
Since Imran Khan was replaced from power 1 month ago, has there been any fundamental changes in terms of policy that he's brought forward?
His policies have been completely turned around. His policy was for independent foreign policy. That was a major concern that has been completely diluted with the new government, because the new government is really whole country in a sham. When you have a coup like this, I don't think we have any idea. For us, it's just a matter of simple foreign policy decision to bring in someone who will cooperate with our view of the region. We don't think much more than that, but it leads to so many ramifications for the affected country. It's hard to even imagine. So right now what's happening is that the new prime minister is scrambling all over the world to get funding. He got some funding from Saudi Arabia and requesting the IMF to extend the loan. And you know, every new regime that comes in uses the existing regime for causing the problem. But you know, time will tell. I am not sure to what extent these accusations are accurate, that there was bad governance on the part of Imran Khan's government. I'm not so sure to what extent I can believe it. But mainly, you know, what is of concern is the assassination attempts on Imran Khan. You know, when we make foreign policy decisions to replace someone, I don't think we really deep down want the person to be eliminated. But the local people who take power, they have to then guard themselves against reprisals, repercussions. So they just eliminate the person, the opponent. So at this time, there is a lot of talk of assassinating Imran Khan and a lot of warnings from the government and a lot of advice from even the military that he should not call his big meeting where he expects about 2 million people to show up end of this month. Oh. And there's an attempt also to have him arrested. So, you know, that's the situation right now.
Oh my goodness. So you mean to say that like the deals with like the defense deal between the United States, Russia and Pakistan is over, and that Pakistan's no longer part of the CPEC with China?
The deal with Russia was close to being completed when Imran Khan was overthrown. So that hasn't gone through. That was a huge breakthrough for Pakistan's economy, 30% discount, all 30% discount on wheat. And Imran was just working for the benefit of the masses who were struggling with this global inflation with COVID thrown in. And that was not completely carried out. And I think it will not happen. The US will dictate terms. The US government will dictate terms with regard to Russia for sure. With China, remember China is the biggest investor in Pakistan's market with close to $60 billion of investment in the program called CPAC, which means China, Pakistan Economic Corridor. And they are involved in many projects which are going to be very beneficial to Pakistan and China. The US has never liked the close relation of Pakistan with China, because China is a potential threat to US economy. And the US government forgets that in 1971, it's Pakistan that enabled the first meeting between US and China. It was a secret meeting when Kissinger flew to Islamabad, to Pakistan, and then Pakistan's government arranged that secret meeting. So that brought together the two big powers. So Pakistan was instrumental in doing that. So my take is, Michael, that Pakistan could play a similar role to bring together Russia and the US to mitigate the tensions. Pakistan believes in, believed under Imran Khan, no bases in Pakistan, no foreign bases, no participation in foreign. And I don't know what is going to happen now with terrorism in Pakistan. Already the Taliban are attacking Pakistan. Pakistan retaliated, and there were 47 Taliban killed inside Afghanistan. So this has been happening in the past. And now this will escalate. The terrorism was brought under control under Imran Khan because he wished to have a negotiated settlement with Taliban. There is no military solution. He was perfectly right. What we got out of 20 years of war was to replace the Taliban with trillions of dollars of expense and so many deaths. So I think that the reversal has taken place in the foreign policy with the new government.
What can you tell me about the new prime minister, Shehbaz Sharif?
Shehbaz Sharif has many cases pending against him for corruption and money laundering, like his older brother. He has the power to have those cases pawned in the federal judiciaries. Judiciaries in the system, the whole of institutions is totally still the same that was there before Imran Khan. The system is the same. He tried to change from one. He failed miserably because the system is there. And what they do is, Michael, whenever there's a hearing, the judges postpone the hearing to the next day, to the next day. So Imran was furious a few times. He said, judiciary is not doing its job. So he has a lot of cases. He doesn't have a clean slate. You can say that he is almost like on bail, and so are many of his cabinet members. But he is a good manager. When he was chief minister of Punjab, which is the biggest province in Pakistan, he did some good work in building his home city, Lahore, and the area. So he is a good manager, and I believe he will do whatever the US wants him to do. And since he may be able to get Pakistan some benefit in the short run, but the people are not going to accept it. See, millions of people are coming out all over the world. They demand election. In the elections, Imran will have 2/3 of majority that he needs. His problem was, Michael, that he didn't have an absolute majority when he won elections in 2018. He had to work, compromise, and with people with whom he totally disagreed. So it was very difficult. Now, if the elections are held, he will have an absolute majority and he can then implement the vision that got postponed because of the corruption in all these institutions that he inherited.
Now, this sort of brings us to your latest essay, The American-Style Colonialism and Imperialism with Pakistan, the Latest Victim. You lay out how the status as an American conquest is protected by the local puppets who succeed one another. Every once in a while, somebody will actually place the interests of the country ahead of the welfare of US wealth and geopolitical interests. In Pakistan, before Khan, we had Benazir Bhutto, who was assassinated in 1977. What were the dynamics that played out in that case?
1997, I think she was assassinated. 77 is when Ziaul Haq overthrew the democratic government of Bhutto, and then he was hanged by Ziaul Haq. That is the last clear demonstration of US interference in the internal affairs of Pakistan. It was in 1977, July 5th, to be accurate. I had flown to Pakistan on a visit on July 4th because I enjoyed the people didn't travel much. It was an American plane, but I could sleep on the plane. So I traveled and I woke up to the news that the country's government had overthrown. And I came to know, I heard some people in the military, some friends. I came to know that the last pieces of the strategy were finalized in the American embassy on. So Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was overthrown. And then a couple of years later, he was executed. What happened to the country since then? And what did Ziaul bring to the country? This is mind-boggling. He has done the most amount of damage to the country single-handedly. It was a liberal democracy under Bhutto. Bhutto was not perfect. I am just talking about the democracy that was in place, and it was a liberal democracy. Ziaul Haq brought in the extreme Wahhabi, Saudi Arabian imported version of Islam, and curtailing women's rights, freedom of speech. And he came for 90 days. To have elections, but he stayed in power until he was assassinated. He was killed in an airplane crash. So that also brought in all kind of terrorists from all over the world. So they were funded by the US through Pakistan. The US and Saudi Arabia funded them under Ziaul Haq to fight the Soviet Union, 79 invasion of Afghanistan. And so just imagine those people came from 40 different countries and they landed in Afghanistan with the help of Pakistan, ISI, and the US training. So what happened? They destroyed the social fabric of the society because once the war was over, they were there. They weren't leaving. And I grew up in Pakistan. I don't remember any household owning Kalashnikov. And after the Soviet invasion, the US and this fighters for the US, all that changed the country's society completely. We could walk in Pakistan at 1 a.m., 2 a.m. freely. But then it was just a matter of being caught for ransom if you go to visit Pakistan. Things changed under Imran Khan simply because he said there should be a negotiated settlement, and it is cultural imperialism to command another culture to obey us. And that was why he was respected by the Taliban, and we started calling him Taliban Khan, which is very ironic.
The elections in Pakistan are set for 2023. What do you think will take place in the interim to foil Khan's attempts to return to power? I mean, you mentioned a possible assassination. I mean, are there other things they could do to finish him off in case he can avoid assassination?
Just yesterday, he said that there are a lot of attempts from all kinds of quarters. He didn't expect some of those. But he was that even if he's assassinated, it will not change the momentum, because the youth, which is more aware than ever before, they want the restoration of a government that is representative of their will. And his party, Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, which meaning Justice Party, Pakistan Movement for Justice, they will sweep the election. And the current government is trying to postpone the election until, as you said, 2023. And that in the interim, many things can happen. You can have, hopefully, the worst scenario is civil war. That is, nobody wishes. In Syria, we didn't think anything would happen to that. When we interfered, others interfered. One side was, Russia. On the other side was the US, the proxy war. 250,000 people have been killed, and many millions displaced. We don't know. See, when these things happen, they have their own momentum. They take the ugliest possible turns you can't imagine. So what will happen, Michael, it's anybody's guess. The worst scenario is civil war. Within my own family, there's a civil war going on. So I can tell you that there's a lot of tension. People in Saudi Arabia, there was an spontaneous demonstration against Shahbaz. He had gone to Saudi Arabia and get funding. It is pretty much of a convention to go to the holy site in Saudi Arabia to offer prayers. So Shahbaz was there, Shahbaz Sharif, and the crowd saw him, recognized him, and the Pakistanis living in Saudi Arabia, they erupted with thief. And there was a pretty much of a riot. The police came in and more people joined in, and Sharif and his entourage were attacked. And the Saudi Arabian government arrested people from both sides, and they have some draconian punishment for that, because the government doesn't want any protest, especially that kind in that place. And as you know, they don't like protest, period. So they're going to give huge sentences. The worst part of that incident was, to me, an FIR registered in a city in Pakistan to introduce the idea of assassinating Imran on religious grounds, that he has done a sacrilege to a holy site, because he is behind the whole riot that he instigated. Now, he was in Pakistan, of course. There is no legal validity to this, and it won't win the court. The problem is, it unleashes a tsunami of hatred and fanaticism. There was a governor in Pakistan who simply said the blasphemy laws should be used carefully, because a Christian woman was being famed, according to sources, for blasphemy. And he intervened. He said, blasphemy is a very sensitive legal item. We have to use it very carefully. He was assassinated by a fanatic because he thought he was being too soft on Christian minority and defaming and blaspheming the prophet. So, you know, this was the attempt to create a legal basis. First information report, FIR is a legal document, the police registers it. And then it unleashes all these currents of hate, totally unfounded. That is the worst case scenario that could happen. That kind of assassination could take place. Civil war is also a possibility. And it's also possible to be very hopeful that the current government will continue until the election and the interim will not see any big upheavals other than Imran Khan's speeches. And he insists on nonviolence. He does not want his followers to do any violence. So it is possible that it will happen. That probably would be the best case scenario, short of elections.
Okay. Well, that's fascinating realities playing out. Professor Jabbar, I'm afraid we are out of time now, but you've brought us a lot to think about. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on your program.
We've been speaking with Professor Abdul Jabbar, academic, scholar, and author from City College of San Francisco. Some of his recent articles, including his essay, American Style Colonialism and Imperialism with Pakistan, the Latest Victim, appear on globalresearch.ca.
So some recent news, hot off the press from earlier today, source VOA News. A bomb blast, improvised explosive device planted on a motorcycle went off just before midnight in the busy Sadar commercial area of the port city of Karachi in southern Pakistan. The explosion killed one and injured 13 people. Several vehicles were damaged by the blast, including the suspected target, a van carrying Pakistani maritime security forces. Karachi Police Chief Ghulam Nabi Memon told local press they were undertaking an investigation into the attack. This incident takes place a little over 2 weeks since a female suicide bomber named Sherry Balok set off a charge that killed herself and four others outside the Karachi University's Confucius Institute. Three Chinese teachers and a Pakistani driver were killed. Four others were injured. Shortly after this attack, it was revealed that the Balochistan Liberation Army was responsible for the violent incident. Here's a recording of what these operatives, now branded terrorists, had to say.
The motive of our attack was very clear. It was a simple and clear message to China and Pakistan to withdraw immediately from Balochistan. This warning to China and Pakistan was also given by our leader, General Aslam Baloch, but China failed to pay heed. We once again make it clear that Gawadar and the rest of Balochistan belong to Baloch. It's our duty to protect our land and sea, our operation Zir Pahazel. This is a continuous operation that has been initiated to safeguard the Baloch Sea from China, Pakistan, and other foreign powers. China, you came here without our consent, supported our enemies, helped Pakistani military in wiping our villages. But now it's our turn. Baloch Liberation Army guarantees you that CPAC will fail miserably on Baloch land. Majid Brigade comprises of a large number of volunteers who are ready to sacrifice themselves to protect our land. A special unit in Majid Brigade has been formed particularly to attack Chinese officials and installations in Balochistan. President Xi Jinping, you still have time to quit Balochistan. or you will witness a retaliation from Baloch sons and daughters that you will never forget. General Aslam Baloch's mission will continue.
As of 2004, the BLA has waged violent armed struggle in favor of self-determination for the people of Balochistan and independence from the rest of Pakistan. What is novel about the April 26th attack, and possibly a similar attack carried out today, is that they were carried out in Karachi and seemed to target the Chinese working in the area. Pepe Escobar was the writer who wrote a piece about the incident in The Cradle. It was entitled Terror from Balochistan, a Menacing Tool to Disrupt Sino-Pakistani Economics. He maintains in his article that this was not just a standard terrorist attack. It struck at the heart of the Pakistan-Chinese partnership and would reverberate not just in the local community or in the region, but would strike a blow against the entirety of Eurasia, as it was Eurasian integration benefiting each of the participants. He also points out that the U.S. had a role to play in funding and redirecting the group, just as ISIS and Al-Qaeda play roles advancing U.S. geopolitical interests. The BLA plays a similar role. The province of Balochistan plays a critical role as a separate entity. Years ago, it was marked as an entity on a map used by U.S. military personnel. Balochistan is rich in minerals like uranium and copper. It also has a lot of oil and holds a lot of gas. An article written way back in December of 2007 takes up the view that the Anglo-American alliance considers these resources strategic, which lends support for a policy of Balkanization of the broader country. This was an article written by Michelle Chosadovsky. So their support for the BLA would be strategic. Indeed, according to a recent update of that article, Chosadovsky showed that there existed a 2005 report by the U.S. National Intelligence Council and the CIA, which anticipated Pakistan would become a failed state by 2015, quote, as it would be affected by civil war, complete Talibanization, and struggle for control of its nuclear weapons, unquote. So overall, the weakening of the state and its Balkanization would play into the imperial agenda of the United States at the expense of China. With that, we will end this episode of the Global Research News Hour. Next week, we will be exploring the state of war, not in Ukraine, but in Ethiopia, planning for a complete report in 7 days' time. Listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show is aired on other radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. Leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been the show's host and producer, Michael Welch. Thank you once again for joining us.